I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drumm. Good morning, Martin. How are you today?
Good morning, Michael. Feeling good.
In the world of sort of politics, international relations, I suppose there are sort of up days and down days. We seem to be living in a period of down days at the minute. I see overnight President Putin has sort of suggested the West is crumbling and they should stop threatening him and he'll sort it all out, I suppose the implication is, by continuing to move on the Ukraine. Are we going to see, Martin, just a drawn out long conflict here, something like the Second World War, Vietnam, Afghanistan? What's the current take of the aficionado in the world of international relations?
Yeah, I was curious about his talk because he talked about this being the most dangerous decade since World War II. And I'm thinking, yeah, but you're contributing to that, to the dangerous times. So don't complain about something you're a part of and a contributing factor towards. But it's an interesting to look back at history and try and compare. If I was making a comparison, it would be about Afghanistan, but not the Afghanistan we think about. I'd be comparing with the Afghan invasion by the Soviet Union in 1979, I should say, which went on for 10 years. And it was messy. And the reason why I think it's a good comparison is the West never directly engaged the Soviet Union. They just supported a ragtag bunch of mujahideen that were fighting them in Afghanistan. And it ground down over time the Russians, and eventually they left. Now, I'm not trying to say that this was a desanitized conflict. It was awful. It was dreadful for Afghanistan, and it led directly to the rise of extremism. And the groups that actually the West funded ended up being the extremist groups. So I think the outcome of that wasn't necessarily great either. The overall message is there's no war that I can think of that actually ended up really helping people that much. Generally, wars result in a lot of destruction and extraordinary trauma. So, but that 10-year war, you would not want the Ukraine conflict to go on for 10 years. You'd hope that there's some kind of political or diplomatic solution before then. But the way that Putin, his war rhetoric sort of suggests that he's not backing down anytime soon.
Well, earlier in the week, interestingly, particularly for Fremantle and Perth people, those on the Indian Ocean side of this huge continent of ours were treated to the visit by the Japanese Prime Minister, who obviously came to cuddle a koala with our Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. What did they get up to, and what was that all about, Martin?
It was all about the economic opportunities that might exist in Western Australia and trying to develop those. It was about bringing Japan closer to the fold in a fairly complicated and messy broader geopolitical scene. So Japan is underestimated. We talk a lot about the US, but actually Japan and Australia are very, very close and have been for a long period of time. And there's specific economic ties that they're looking to advance in WA. And I think that that's a fairly non-controversial relationship for us to be really exploiting. So the koalas are thrown in for the fuzzy photo shoot, but I don't want to disappoint you too much, but they weren't actually the centre part of the visit.
Oh, I obviously completely misread the news.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Michael, you got it all wrong.
It's not a koala export industry that we're setting up.
Well, those of you that know our wildlife and our fauna well know that our koalas are eastern coast beasts in the Australian context, and there's some here, but they were brought here, so they're not really that prolific in the west coast at all.
It actually did confuse me, that photo, when I first saw it, for the reason you've just mentioned. Like kookaburras, I seem to have just intruded, but I digress ever so slightly. Cost of living around the world, often attributed to Ukraine and reasonably so, continues to fill up our airwaves and all the broadcasting, television, radio. the budget has come down this week and there's been a reply to it. Let's take them in that order. What did you make of Jim Chalmers' first budget?
It was a calm, modest, even boring budget, but that's okay. I think that, you know, it's not about having snazzy announcements you make. It's about trying to put the economy on a more solid footing. Now, I say it's okay. It won't solve some problems that are very significant. Housing's a really significant problem. And despite a big picture announcement, if you drill down to it, I think that there's still a massive gap in the things that we're doing on the ground to resolve that particular issue. Nor is it resolving one of the core issues that people are facing, and that's around the cost of living. So the problem with trying to resolve the cost of living in an inflationary environment is that the government stimulates by putting more cash in your pockets, it just drives prices further up. So they've actually got very limited levers they can use to try and resolve a cost of living. They can try and intervene more and more in the market, but that itself is problematic in other ways. So overall, I think that it's a fairly sound piece, but it actually still doesn't address some of the basic problems people face. And particularly if you're on a low income, in effect, your wage is going backwards because of the way that prices are rising.
I was sort of bemused in one sense. There was an announcement about 1 million houses being built, and I wondered, apart from anything else, whether we're going to get the people to build them. Even if they had all the money and it was going to happen in a short period of time. But then Mr. Dutton came along and in a very measured way, without any particular hysterics as much as I saw, responded to it all. But leaving aside his economic response, he seemed to have a non-economic response to the budget, Martin. What did you make of that?
It was an interesting speech. The first thing about budget reply speeches that all of us need to remember is that they're not actually budget reply speeches. They're actually stump speeches for the opposition leader when they've got a moment in the nation's gaze to pitch themselves and what they've got to offer. Actually, they often don't talk that much about what they've got to offer. They try to give you a bit of a feel-good spiel about themselves, particularly new opposition leader like Peter Dutton. So there's a lot of stuff about him growing up in a, you know, fairly modest environment, making his own way, buying his house at a really young age, having to save up, and it's so harder for people to do that today. It was almost a folksy tale at times about his past. But the other curious thing that you picked up on, there was some markers laid out, I think, from the opposition that this is not going to be some consensus-based parliament. They've got very clear points of difference. A lot of scepticism about the government's increased targets, carbon reduction targets for 2030, and how they're going to be achieved. Cynicism, there was even a temporary drive into the culture wars about what's being taught in education in schools. Also, I read it as in part a sort of bit of a call to arms for Peter Dutton for his own base. So this is why you should support me, colleagues, and then broader membership, because I'm a true blue liberal conservative. I think he's shoring that up first before he's charging out to try and convince the rest of the electorate to vote for him, which is not happening until 2025, of course.
Well, I'm not sure that he mentioned netball. But netball is a great game, and I tried playing it once or twice socially, and it's a lot harder than you think, particularly when you have to keep your feet on the ground. Although Ms. Wallum, when she advanced on the net with two wonderful steps and bounced up like a tall basketballer and dropped the netball into the net to win against England, sort of took the game to new heights, if you'll excuse my developing pun here, Martin. But netball, a short $15 million that they are no longer getting from Gina Hancock Prospecting. What have you made of this great debate? Of course, it's not just confined to netball. The Socceroos are out talking about fixing the world, at least in Qatar. What do you make of it all?
It is fascinating. So sport, some people say sport and politics don't mix, but shouldn't mix, but they've actually been, there's been politics and sport and politics for decades and decades. So that's nothing new. It's part of this broader discussion around that social license that business has and how that fits into changing values and beliefs, et cetera. And we had a discussion last week around Woodside and the Dockers, and there's some, of course, some parallels here too. On the one hand, I think any sponsor is entitled to sponsor or not sponsor anyone of their choice. So that's entirely Gina's prerogative if she's pulling that money. But I also think there will be an increasing number of athletes that start talking about the brand that they're associated with and whether they're comfortable or not comfortable with being associated with that brand. So the issue is not going away. I actually think it's going to get more and more marketed. And because previously athletes had a lot of say over their individual brand marketing. So if you want a shoe sponsor, are you happy with that shoe sponsor and what they're doing, et cetera? But now I think athletes are now starting to make more of a stand about the collective team sponsorships that they're involved in. And then the CEOs of the organisations that like Netball Australia are saying, hang on, that's our prerogative. That's what we decide. But watch this space, because player associations are having more and more say. And I wouldn't be surprised if these conversations aren't replicated across other sports.
At a sort of commercial slash political level, the only thing that has really surprised me in all of this debate is that Gina Hancock hasn't dissociated herself in an express, unambiguous way from the comments her late father made back in 1984, not so long ago, about taking steps which might sterilise the Aboriginal population so they could die out. I mean, it was the most appalling thing at the time, and was so sickening that you just said it and shook your head. I'm really surprised she hasn't dealt with that. It would be a good idea.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Michael. Of course, the comments are just awful, and they just jar you when you hear them today. And 1984 might sound like a long while ago, but it's not that far ago. We were all around then, weren't we, Michael? Gina's always been a contrarian. I don't think she's ever felt that she wanted to sort of play the politics game, the public image game that some of the other mining barons like Andrew Forrest have done much more assiduously. I think that she's cultivated an image where she often doesn't care about those things. But you're right, what that can do is you can let that run, and that might overshadow other good things that you do. So some of the defenders of Hancock Prospecting have pointed out different sponsorships she's done and other programs that she's run with Indigenous groups. And I'm not across all of those, and if she's done that, that's fantastic. But if you let those things run, no one's necessarily saying you're responsible for everything your dad said, but an opportunity to repudiate that probably is going to make a big difference to a range of people to say that's horrific. You know, I'm uncomfortable in the same room given all of this history. The same as the reconciliation debate. People say, well, what responsibility do any of us have? Well, now, these things were done in our name, in the government's name, and is it any wonder that people, Aboriginal people, will feel uncomfortable in an environment where these things have never been addressed? So I think it'd be a wise thing, but I'm not sure that we'll see Gina be doing that anytime soon. I don't think it's the way she does things.
Well, stay with the theme of politics and sport. During the week, the regular accounting from politicians about who gave them gifts, money, or things that can be expressed in money terms came out. Looks like a good number of the West Australian ministerial population really do love their football. Lanny McTiernan fessed up, it sounded like, being a great friend of the Eagles and having to go along to Nigel Satterley's box regularly. Others took the money from Tabcorp to go and watch the grand final when Melbourne won here all over a year ago, of course. the Premier has starkly defended it all by saying, oh, well, if we don't go to the footy, we'll be told we're out of touch, and if we do go, we'll be criticised because someone paid for us to go. It doesn't seem to be an automatic logical connection between those two statements, but what do you make of it all? Should politicians be much more circumspect about the private dollar?
It's an interesting one. To be honest, I was uncomfortable with the revelations. It's not that I'm accusing anyone of doing anything wrong, and per se, like, you know, nothing like corrupt behaviour. But you know, it hasn't been exposed as an issue in Western Australia as much, but property developers in other states, it's been an enormous number of issues, including corruption in other jurisdictions. Because property developers need the support of government as part of their business model. The decisions by government to open up development and to allow certain scales of density, the conditions of development, et cetera, are integral to their business model, and there's a lot of money at stake. So it's not that people are explicitly doing something corrupt or wrong, it's just that it makes some of us uncomfortable because of those really close connections. That's probably where I'd sit there. And it's worth mentioning that in a number of other states, property developers have been completely banned from making any political donations. Now, I'm not suggesting necessarily, I prefer transparency than bans like that, and disclosure than bans like that. But I think that there's a reason why other states have done that. So, I'd prefer that they were arm's length. But, I mean, how do you control relationships, Michael?
Well, we've got a triple C that at least can keep an eye on it. Parliament itself, through question time, of course, ought to be able to help regulate what happens. But we'll continue to watch with interest. One thing that goes on, and we still haven't seen an end of, is the industrial fracas between the nurses, generally speaking, and the state government. There are offers for increases on the table, better pay and conditions, but it lingers on, not quite like Ukraine yet, but it lingers on. What's going on?
And it's worth probably adding the police union to this now too, because they've arced up and they're threatening all industrial action as well. What we've seen is a suppression of WA public sector wages for a number of years now, perhaps with good reason, because the operational budget of Western Australia was quite challenging when the Labor government first came to power. But we're now, things have changed. We're now in a significant inflationary environment where the cost of living is rising, and there is a need for wages to keep pace with that. So I think that the government will need to make more concessions here. If they can't make concessions on wages, they'll have to make them on conditions. And there's some discussion around that. But I think that we're a fair way from settlement here, and we're going to see more tension and perhaps more industrial action from nurses, perhaps other public sector workforces like police, et cetera, if they can't get an agreement they're happy with.
Well, Martin, we're coming to the end of this view from the roundhouse. I suppose we shouldn't ignore the fact that the UK, Britain, has its first Asian Prime Minister 150 years ago, a little bit less than that, Benjamin Disraeli, the first Jewish Prime Minister of Britain, arrived. Are we in tumultuous times, do you think? Or the Brits in tumultuous times with all of what's happening? Will they last? When do they have to go to a general election?
Oh, they're still a couple of years away from a general election. They have five-year terms, which is probably at least a year long in my view. I think four is probably about right. Look, I think this is a really major milestone. It's the reason you go to the UK, the contribution that people from South Asia in particular make to their overall community, economy, society, particularly food, is astonishing. You know, of course, Britain was famously a former colonial power through much of the South Asian area, including modern-day India and Pakistan, etc. So this is a milestone. It's something we should welcome. People need to judge their new prime minister on his performance, like any other prime minister over time. But it's just good to see people from different backgrounds make it all the way to the top, even in a place like Britain, which is known for its tradition, and it's a bit harder to crack the top there. And also, it's worth probably saying for a Conservative government that's been very, very messy and chaotic, I've got to say, but one thing that they have done is that they've been able to promote a whole range of people from different backgrounds and diversity and gender to high positions. So I'll give them that. That's a step forward.
Well, Martin, it's as always been lovely talking to you. Thank you for sharing your views about the range of topics we've got today. I'm sure in the next couple of weeks, things we can't even imagine will be on our plate. But until then, been lovely talking to you.
Thanks, Michael.